Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig.
And that's Ann, and this is Peter, just in case you were wondering.
Right. And the subject today is, it's sort of like a potpourri of cooking styles.
Is that what it is? Okay.
Well, it's not actually, because we're going to start with beer.
That's important. We don't dedicate nearly enough time on this program
to beer.
So when an exciting new book crossed our desk, we just decided we just had to talk to Jane Payton, and we just had to include her at the beginning of today's program.
Well, so, especially since she's from Yorkshire.
Well, that has something to do with it. A little bit of hometown bragging doesn't hurt.
Right.
And it turns out that this totally charming, rather tiny little book is absolutely packed with information. And starting from the fascinating title, Beer O'Clock. So here's Jane Payton. Not only was Jane Payton the head girl of Skipton Girls Grammar School, but she has gone on to a distinguished career in a very, what most people would consider, a masculine profession. Explain what you do, Jane.
My name is Jane Payton. I am a beer sommelier. I'm actually Britain's beer sommelier of the year.
Oh, wow.
I work in the beer industry, thank you, primarily. And I advocate about beer. I brew beer. I drink it. I evangelise. I'm also currently working on the Beer Day Britain, which will be Britain's first national beer day. I'm the instigator of it, and I'm the project manager. So, yes, I live, breathe, drink, and dream about beer, and I'm very lucky because it's a great industry to work in, very friendly, and really good fun.
And your parents are proud of you, I'm sure.
They were very proud of me, and I've written several books, and they live to see me publish several books. So, yes, they were very proud, and I think they would be very proud now if they knew what I was doing.
And the book we're talking about, which brought you to our attention, is called Beer O'Clock. Now, that title itself needs a bit of an explanation.
Well, the title Beer O'Clock, it's quite a popular phrase in not just the beer world, actually, because I've heard people describe wine o'clock, cake o'clock. So basically it means that it's time for either a beer or a cake or a wine. It's just a funny phrase that means give me a glass or a plate of your favourite food or drink.
So it's sort of like the sun is over the yardarm somewhere in the world, so it must be the cocktail hour.
Exactly.
Now, I'm going to pose you, it's almost an embarrassing question, because I've lived in these United States for 40 years and studied the development of craft beer here in this country, very much so in the last decade or so. But when I see Bud Light as the preferred and most expensive draft beer in a pub in England, it makes me want to cry. Can you explain that?
I'm not surprised. You'll find that less and less, actually. When were you last here in Britain, and where did you see Bud Light as an option?
Well,
and then I'll explain it.
I must confess, we haven't actually been much in pubs in the last two or three times we've come. We come over to England at least twice a year. My brother and his family live in Cornwall, and our nephew Alan starts collecting beer in June, and every Friday when he gets paid, he buys several bottles of beer, and he saves them until Christmas time. And every year in June, he says, by the way, are you coming for Christmas so I know how many to get?
Well, it sounds like a good relation to have. But just getting back to your question earlier about Bud Light, it's unlikely that you would see that now as a premium beer in Britain. But historically, a few years, Bud was the American beer. And it was the only American beer that you could get in Britain. And it's a popular beer all around the world. The same reason that in America, Americans think that Newcastle Brown Ale is posh beer. You know, if it was here in Britain, we wouldn't wash the floor with that beer. And it's probably the same for you when you look at Bud Light and that being popular in Britain and around the world. It's marketing, it's different markets, how it's posed and how it's positioned. You know, some people just want that American thing. They think, oh, that's a typical American beer. I must have some of that.
Okay, and you're saying that the marketers of Newcastle Brown succeeded in doing the same thing over here?
Oh, big time. You know, the whole reason that Newcastle Brown still has a market is because of America. People in Britain barely drink Newcastle Brown Ale, or Newquay Brown as it's called here. It's a joke, actually. It's a joke beer here. But in America, it's considered to be a quite high-end beer that's very desirable. So just different markets. You know, there's a very popular beer in Britain called Peroni. It's an Italian style of Pilsner. In Italy, that is hardly, you know, it's not a big beer in Italy. But in Britain, very premium. People will pay £5.50 for a pint of Peroni.
Now, I'm going to say something here that is going to shock Anne, and you're just going to accept the compliment. Because we've seen lots and lots of books about beer, including books from the famous R.I.P. Michael Jackson. But this compact booklet, Beer O'Clock, contains so much information. I'm going to say that it might be the only book about beer that you need. How do you think? Well, what do you think about that? Now,
that's fantastic! Thank you so much.
Now, when we go over the
real compliment.
Now, when we go over the contents, I think our listeners will understand better why I say that. So, why don't you tell our listeners around the world what's in the story? What's inside the cover?
Well, I wrote the book as a book that would explain beer, would enthuse people about beer, it would educate it in a readable way and an accessible way, so people who already knew a lot about beer would be able to get something out of the book. And people who didn't know an awful lot about beer or knew nothing about beer would also get something out of it. So it takes you right from the history of beer, which is much older than we think, at least 9,000 years old. It goes through how to brew, but in a very accessible and easy to understand way, how to taste beer properly like a professional. It then goes on and talks about all the different beer styles. Now, there are dozens of beer styles around the world. So it gives you a description of what they are and the serving temperature and food you should put with them and the tasting notes on them. It also goes on about glassware, because the shape of the glass is very important in how you really appreciate the beer. And it will enhance certain flavours in the beer depending on the shape of the glass. It goes on to talk about beer and health. Now, in moderation, there are proven health benefits to beer. It's all about moderation. And not smoking cigarettes. It goes on about matching beer with food, because beer is actually a really fine match for food, much more so than wine, I would say, for various reasons. It goes on about beers that rule the world, about the great brewing nations. It talks about boozers in Britain, the lovely pubs in Britain, and it gives you some beer knowledge as well, like trivia that you can talk to your friends down the bar or the pub and bamboozle them with your knowledge.
Yes,
it's got something for everybody.
And you've got lots of recommendations, but you've got some really interesting factual, or at least I'll assume it's factual information, because I'm sure you've done your homework. But one thing that Americans are particularly guilty of in drinking beer, and it may be that they just don't care for their beer all that well, and that's drinking it straight out of the bottle or can. Now, we got the tip on this from somebody who worked for Pilsner Urquell. And he said, please remember that beer is supposed to be drunk out of a glass. It's supposed to be poured out of the container. And the pouring of it and the result of that has something to do with how it tastes. Now, would you agree?
Yes, very much so. And also, when we eat and drink, if we have sight, you know, if we're not blind, then looking and enjoying what the food and drink looks like is part of the enjoyment of the food or drink. So the way the beer is presented in the glass is really important, and it gets our juices going and our anticipation. And again, you know, I'll go back to the shape of the glass being important in helping us appreciate it. Now, there's something else really practical. If you drink out of a can or a bottle, you don't smell the beer. And our brains register most aroma or most flavour through the olfactory cells, which are the smell cells, in our noses. So the tongue is actually it's a crude instrument when it comes to tasting anything, because all it recognises on the tongue is salt, sweet, sour,
right,
bitterness, and savoury, umami. So all those wonderful caramel and chocolate and biscuity and citrusy and tropical fruit notes on beer come through the nose. Well, you don't get that if you drink it from a can, but you get that if you drink it from the glass. Also, you know, somebody's taken an awful lot of time and passion to make that beer, and I think we should give it the reverence it deserves and present it in its best way.
Oh, that's really...
We wouldn't eat food out of the... most people wouldn't eat food out of the packaging. they put it on a plate, and it's the same with beer.
Well, I think that's a wonderful explanation. Now, one of the things that surprised me, Jane, was that your Hall of Fame was very short. You have a chapter called the Beer Hall of Fame.
Well, they were the ones that really, for me, are the really great breweries that I really enjoy the beer, or they've done something so remarkable. It could have gone on forever. The Hall of Fame could have been so wide, but I chose to be very narrow on either people or breweries that have made such an impact either on the beer world or on me.
Okay, so that's a short list, right?
It's a short list. I would add some to it myself, but
I could.
And then that doesn't mean I'm right. I mean,
Well, everybody's different. That was just my Hall of Fame. Everybody else will have their own opinions or additions to it. So
are there Americans
Hall
on there?
Of Fame.
Yeah, the isn't the founder of
Sierra Nevada? Yeah. Sierra Nevada are on there. Without Sierra Nevada and O'Dell's, Boston Beer Company, Samuel Adams, and I suppose Anchor as well, Anchor Steam Beer. You know, this beer revolution, what's called the craft beer revolution, wouldn't have happened. So I'm very, very big thumbs up to Sierra Nevada in particular. I love their beers.
What about Dogfish?
Hold on a second. I wanted to just insert someone here because I think that many people would put Fritz Maytag and Anchor Steam ahead of Sierra Nevada. And it was probably only because Fritz Maytag had a fairly inexhaustible supply of money that he could do pretty much as he pleased. His family, by the way, makes appliances.
Yes, I'm aware of that. This is it's a personal choice, the Hall of Fame. So everybody's going to have a different opinion, and they're going to have a different opinion of who was more influential. To me, and in Britain, and this book was written by a Briton in Britain, to me, Sierra Nevada are the ones. But I'm aware of Fritz Maytag and the Anchor Brewery.
I have a question. Beer that was accidentally discovered, what did it taste like?
Well, it would have probably tasted more like, if I describe something called Horlicks, you may not know what that means, but it's a product that's very biscuity and malty and quite sweet. It's made from malted barley. Imagine a malted milkshake, that taste of malt.
Mm-hmm. It's like what beer would have tasted like.
Because the early beers would have tasted more like that, more sweeter and thicker as well, much more soupy.
Well, that's wine, too. It was all honey wine to start with.
Yeah, it's similar
Mead,
to... I think you get Ovaltine here, right?
Uh-huh.
In the States. So Horlicks is a lot like Ovaltine, right?
Yes, Ovaltine, exactly. That sort of taste. So what you'd do to, ancient Egyptians would have been drinking their ale, but they would have had a little dish of bitter herbs. They would put the bitter herbs in the side of the mouth. So as they were drinking the ale, which was sweetish, then the bitterness would have kicked in through whatever herbs they were putting in there. The hops, which we now get bitterness from, didn't exist in those days.
Who had that brilliant idea, Jane?
What about hops?
Yes, why would you even grow them in the first place? They're not really used for anything else, are they?
The Romans ate the shoots, so you can eat the hop shoots, and their medicine as well. Hops have got some various medicinal properties. They grow wild. It's a it's a cool climate plant, Northern Europe plant, and the first written evidence of hops being used, not necessarily for beer, but just hops, was in the 9th century in a French monastery. That doesn't mean to say they were being used in beer, but the first person to actually say hops are good to put into drinks, beer and other drinks, was a mystic nun called Saint Hildegard of Bingen.
Oh.
She was a herbalist as well as she was a multitasker because she did lots of musical compositions as well. Saint Hildegard, she wrote that hops prevented food and drink from putrefying. So she's the one that realized they gave beer a shelf life if you put hops into it.
Uh-huh.
So we need to thank her a lot. If you're a hophead, which I am, thank her a lot.
Uh-huh.
So you like IPAs a lot, which are heavily hopped beer, but one of the things you debunk is the false impression that I've had for years and that I've won many contests in bars talking about, that India Pale Ale, it was brewed for shipment to India and the hops were used as a preservative along the way. And you're suggesting that really isn't true.
Well, It is true, because yes, the bird did go to India, and it was highly hot, but people say that it was invented specifically to go to India, and highly hot specifically to go to India, and that's not true. The truth is what's in the book, which is, it was a style of beer called something else. It was called October Ale, and it was just a fluke that it ended up in India in the first place, because it was being brewed by a brewer whose brewery was by the East Indies Dock in London. So all the ships going out from the East India Dock would carry the beer from the local brewer, and it just happened to be going to India, you know, the ship that it first arrived on. If that brewer had been at the Baltic Dock or the America's Dock or the Greenland Dock, then the beer would have been called something different. And it was only named in East India Pale Ale about 40 years after it had first been exported to India. Now, there's also myths on the internet, and they say, oh, well, it was there so the soldiers could drink it in India. Well, imagine this. This new beer arrives in India. It's the equivalent of the most expensive vintage champagne. You're not going to give it to your soldiers. The soldiers are going to get the basic porter beers, which they did. The people who get that beer, this newfangled, gorgeous, hoppy, pale beer, which is unheard of, it's the high-status people. It's the people who work for the East India Company. So the soldiers may have got it years later when it became commonplace, but when it first arrived, it wasn't for the soldiers. It was for the high-status people in the East India Company. That's the story of it.
See, listeners, I told you there was a lot in this little tiny book. You have another interesting story about the famous Dr. John Snow, and you talk about beer as being an important element in the research that he did in order to track the sources of cholera, because he discovered that people who drank only beer didn't get cholera. And that caused him to look further into the water supply and to find the one pump that was the source of all the pollution that caused that outbreak to take place.
That's right. That was in Soho. And until that point, cholera, people in the Victorian era believed that cholera was caused by miasma, which is bad air. They didn't realize it was a waterborne disease. Now, Dr. Snow suspected that it was passed on by bad water, polluted water. And his suspicions were confirmed when he realized that there was a hot spot to break out of cholera in Soho. And he realized that the men who worked in the brewery adjacent to where the hot spot was were not getting cholera because they were drinking beer. They weren't going to the well, the communal well, which had been infected by human sewage, human waste. And that was causing the water to have cholera just in that local area. So he said to the local council, if you take the handle off that pump, off the communal well, then I think that the outbreak of cholera will cease. And they went, oh, go on then. They didn't really believe him. But they did take the handle off, so nobody could get to the water in that well. And lo and behold, the cholera outbreak stopped. So it was then realised that, yes, it was a waterborne disease. Now, in that area, there's now a pub called the Dr. John Snow. It's right on the corner where the well used to be in Broadwick Street in Soho in central London. And it's there to commemorate him and his discovery.
Well, Jane, I'd like to have a beer with you sometime or a few.
There's a lot to talk about with beer.
Lots of beer.
We'll have to connect up with you at your local ale house.
Oh, yeah, we'll be there.
Next time,
fish
and chips and mushy peas.
Yeah.
There we go. Well, that's another story. I suspect that there might be a food with beer book coming after this one, if I can make a suggestion. In any event, it's been a great pleasure to talk to you, and we wish you luck with this book. We wish you luck with this. What's the name of this great beer event you're organizing?
Beer Gay Britain. It's on June the 15th. 2015, and if I could just say really quickly, that's the same day that Magna Carta was sealed in 1215, and the reason I've chosen that date to be Beer Day Britain is because ale is mentioned in Magna Carta, in clause 35 of Magna Carta. Now, I know that Magna Carta is very important to Americans because it's part, you know, it was an influence on the Revolution and the Bill of Rights. So, yes, we're going to celebrate Magna Carta. And
well,
we're
send us an invitation, because guess what? We'll be in London then.
Well, we may...
We'll just get,
We'll be there around that time.
Go to the pub, and at 12:15 on June the 15th, raise a glass of beer to toast Magna Carta and beer, and that's what we're doing. That's going to be the main thing that day, so there's going to be a national communal cheers to beer and Magna Carta. 12:15 p.m. on June the 15th.
Thanks.
Well, we wish you every success with your continued career in beer. We hope there are more books to follow, and we hope that we'll have the opportunity to meet you in person very soon. Jane, thank you so much for talking to us today.
My pleasure. Thank you, Peter and Anne. Goodbye, and goodbye to all your listeners.
Just to add a little point here that I only just thought of, that listeners may not be around the world, may not be as familiar with parts of the United Kingdom or Great Britain or whatever you like to call it, but Yorkshire is the largest county, far and away the one that we all Yorkshire men and Yorkshire women consider to be the best. A little bit like Texas used to be before it was dwarfed in size by Alaska. But Texans are very proud. Yorkshire people are very proud. They're also considered to have long arms and short pockets, or to throw their money around like a Scotsman with no arms. Two expressions, both of which suggest that the Yorkshire people are thrifty, and I be one of them. Anyway, we'll be back after the break, going a relatively short distance across the Irish Sea to the wonderful, scenic, and culinarily splendid
Emerald Isle.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. Everyone knows who listens to the show that we have a very soft spot in our heart for Irish cuisine, modern Irish
cuisine. Go ahead. Spit it out, dear. Spit it out.
I know. Anyhow, so we're really delighted that Clodagh McKenna had a new book out, and we got to interview her. I'm not able to talk today. I don't know what's wrong. Anyhow, it's called Clodagh's Irish Kitchen.
It's really funny. Clodagh was here in New York City for a few days before St. Patrick's Day. I think she made some appearances on Rachel Ray and some places like that. But she was hightailing it back to Dublin, because in Dublin they have the St. Patrick's Day parade, which is the largest St. Patrick's Day parade in the world, they tell me. And it actually takes place on the day itself. So she actually got back in time to march on Tuesday, but we had the opportunity to talk to her while she was here, and very interesting lady, very dynamic personality.
Dynamite personality, yes.
So, and she really knows her stuff.
Clodagh McKenna, we've talked to you before, and we're glad that you were able to come back, particularly because you produced another book, this one called Clodagh's Irish Kitchen, and I've been breezing through it, and I think this, the recipes are delicious.
Oh, thank you so much. Well, it's so lovely to be back on your show. And, of course, it's always so lovely to hear when somebody likes the book. Yeah, I'm really happy with the book. I love the recipes myself, and they're all the dishes that I love to cook. I'm really happy.
You know, we ought to explain that, I mean, you actually trained in Ireland, but also in France and Italy, and you've incorporated a lot of the French and Irish dishes into your book, coupled with these wonderful, magically pure products that you have access to in Ireland, right?
I have, yeah. What I've done is I've taken, we'll say, traditional dishes, and I've kind of brought them to current kind of cooking and taste that we have to cook right now in Ireland. So, for example, I've taken a Culcannon, taken all the beautiful dishes or the beautiful ingredients from that, and made it into a Culcannon soup with parsley pesto, or let's say my Guinness cake.
Oh, that one I was going to ask you about. I mean,
that's amazing.
Sounds
that's amazing. Then the Bailey's and the Irish soda bread and Bailey's ice cream is a winner. I made it for Rachel Ray on her show, and she said it was the best ice cream she'd ever tasted.
Now, you do have a love for Guinness and chocolate together, so much so that I noticed you had it in two recipes, one for lamb and one for venison.
Yeah, the stew with the Guinness and the chocolate, that sounds amazing.
Yeah.
It's great. You know what? Chocolate has always been used, we'll say, in traditional cooking in France, for bœuf bourguignon, and I decided that to try to integrate it into our Irish stews, because we have the best beef in the, you know, some of the best beef in the world comes from Ireland, and just to how can we bring the Irish stew or the, you know, the beef pies, how can we bring them to an even better tasting, you know, dish? And, you know, so I've integrated some of those, you know, those great ideas into the, into our traditional recipes just to bring them more current. And I feel we have so many people all across the world that have an Irish heritage, but very few of them actually cook Irish. So this is my whole, you could call it a campaign, is that I want people who have any kind of Irish connection or heritage, I want them to, you know, bring that into their lives a bit more and create an Irish kitchen at home, whether it's making a soda bread, like my soda bread and pine bread every Saturday morning, and then maybe on the Sunday with the leftover bread, making the my soda bread and Bailey's ice cream, and, you know, making those lovely Guinness and chocolate and beef butter pastry pies, or just really integrating it into their everyday life and, like, inviting people over for an Irish dinner. God, that makes me so happy, the thought of that.
Now, there are two, I can't say secret ingredients, but two sets of ingredients that I observed all the way through the book, which are uniquely Irish. One is some delicious cheeses that you reference by name, and then the other, I guess, is the wonderful Irish seafood. Would you like to comment on both of those things and why they're so precious?
Yeah, I think because we have such incredible pastures, and or cattle or cows or grass fed, create some incredible dairy products. So we have beautiful cheeses being made in Ireland, right from Castle Blue to Dubliner to other more artisan, like Cabin and Knocklara. And so I love working with them. They're always stocked in my fridge, and they're now accessible kind of all over the world. And they're such clean, beautiful, natural products. And you can taste that goodness in them. You know that that's real goodness in them. And when the ingredients that you're working with, when they taste gorgeous, it's really hard to get it wrong.
Now, you said that you started this. I found this rather curious. Why, with all the wonderful cheeses that you make, why are you making buffalo mozzarella in Ireland?
Yeah, well, you know what? I think it's wonderful that, you know, that there are so many different farmers and producers that have been really, that are trying to create as many of the much-loved foods as possible in Ireland, so we don't have to export, and we're, you know, trying to be as creative and as self-sufficient as possible, because we are in Ireland. And, yeah, the buffalo mozzarella has been made down in Cork, and of course, like, why not, since we have such incredible pastures that we really look after, and because we're a really small island, most of our pastures get swept with, you know, sea breeze.
Right.
Which gives that beautiful salty flavour. So the buffalo mozzarella that's been made in Cork is out of this world. And, like, I've lived in Italy, I've tasted the buffalo mozzarella there. So, you know, the book is full of dishes where they've got a real essence of Ireland in them, but that you can, you know, use local produce, you know, yourself, or maybe add a little bit of Irish produce in there too.
I had an interesting question for you, because when we were in Italy, two or three times, I guess, we crossed the area where the buffalo are so famous, mostly just south and just north of Naples, and we didn't see any. And we were really puzzled about that. And then one year, we finally got the answer. We noticed that we saw the buffalo, but they were all in the shed.
Oh, yeah.
And now, do they do it the same way in Ireland, or surely in Ireland they can just go and eat the grass? They can just roam around and eat the grass.
Well, you know, buffaloes don't produce milk if their temperature is chilled. So that's why they're kept in sheds. I know that just because I spent a couple of days at a buffalo farm in Italy. That's the only reason I know that. It's like a little technical thing. So that's why they're kept in sheds. In the farm in Ireland, as far as I know, I think they're kept outdoors for like a certain amount of months of the year, okay. like 100 or 50, but I'm not exactly sure. I think it's like a third of the year that's kept outdoors.
Well, that's a very sensible answer to why they keep them indoors. So now I understand.
Now,
here's another interesting controversy we became a part of when we were in Ireland, and I want you to comment because this is a lead into seafood. So when we were in Dublin, the first time we were there, I guess, we went to Darina's brother, or was it brother-in-law? I can't remember which. His last name was O'Connell, and he had a restaurant in an unusual part of Dublin, and he served us lobster, and it was some of the freshest lobster we'd ever seen.
Oh, it was fabulous.
And he explained to us that it had only been out of the water for less than 10 hours because it was transported all the way from a fishing port all the way in the southwest in County Kerry to him, but it was alive while he was doing that. So it was really splendid, and he said this was the best lobster in Ireland. We said, okay, you can't get lobsters from the Irish Sea, he said. Well, then a few days later on the same trip, we were in a restaurant in, is it Howth or Hooth, how they pronounce it?
Howth.
And the name... The name King is in the name of the restaurant. I've forgotten the rest of it. King Victor or King Vidor or something King Sidor is the name of the restaurant. And there we had lobster, and in fact we had two lobsters each. and the owner of the establishment who cooked them for us said these most definitely were Irish Sea lobsters. So what's the deal? What's the deal? Can you get seafood everywhere? Yes, you can.
Lobsters.
Can you get lobsters everywhere? It sounds to me like you can, but not everybody knows that.
Yeah, in Ireland, it's probably the most common food that's eaten in Ireland is seafood, because we are in Ireland. Certainly in my restaurant, the number one food that would be ordered would be seafood. So it's really easy for us to access, like, fresh lobster that's brought in that day. I mean, when you said to me there that the restaurant that you went to, you know, it was caught 10 hours, that's kind of just regular in Ireland, because you're never more than 2 hours away from the seashore. Any part of Ireland. So it's like my restaurant, or fish is caught in the morning, from the Dunleary Pier at about, you know, comes in at about 10 in the morning, and we're serving it for lunchtime at 1 o'clock.
Wow.
Now just to quickly emphasize that Dunleary is the port that's associated with Dublin.
Yes.
Now also by way of straightening things out, what are your restaurants named?
My restaurants are Clodagh's Kitchen.
Okay, both of them. There are two?
Yeah, both of them, yeah. Right.
And you do television? You do everything, don't you?
You know what I do? Yeah, I do a live show every Friday and cookery, and I have my two restaurants, and I also do all of the, I've just taken all over the food for, excuse me, Aer Lingus.
I read that, yes.
Yeah, and I write a weekly column, and I write cookery books, and so I'm kept nice and busy.
Yeah, well, you said you now, to keep up your energy, you juice.
I do, I love juicing. It's a big part of my life. I find it really good for energy levels and just making sure that I get, like, enough vitamins every day. So I do, I like to juice, and I like to exercise. You know, it comes to a stage in your life where things become a priority, and definitely health is a big priority. So I like to juice, I like to eat seasonal foods, local, and I like to cook, obviously.
Yes.
I had a question, Clodagh. In the recipe for Green Goddess juice, which I guess is your favorite start of the day, you say the spirulina.
Yeah, I don't know what that is either.
Though it doesn't taste too wonderful, it's packed with protein, vitamins, and minerals. Now, what's the spirulina?
Spirulina is ground seaweed.
Ground seaweed, okay. All right.
Yeah, and it's one of the best things that you can put into your juice.
Oh, I see. I see it in the recipe now. It's 1 teaspoon of spirulina powder, and that's exactly what it is. It's powdered seaweed.
Powdered seaweed, but if you couldn't get spirulina, you could do ground bladderwrack or ground dillisk, whatever it is, whatever kind of seaweed you can get your hands on, or kelp, or
you know, you have
that
to be,
into your juices.
It has to be someplace like Ireland with your coastline for you to devote as much space as you have to seaweed in this book.
Yeah.
Which I adore, by the way.
Well, you know, it's such an accessible raw ingredient that we have, just because of our clean waters and our high tide shellfish. Like, we just have an abundance of seaweed, which gets exported all around the world. So I wanted to include that in the book because it's also very accessible to anybody in the world because you can buy them dried in health food stores and you might be able to buy a pack for like $5. But you could put it into your store cupboard and then just take out a tiny little bit at a time, rehydrate it and blitz it into your salads or your juices, and you just get an instant hit of magnesium and great nutrients.
I love it, love it.
Mm.
Now, you expand on just recipes by actually suggesting occasions, and also I thought it was very interesting, your section on tablescapes. Tell me about that.
I love tablescaping. I love beautiful tables. I think life is all about like capturing beautiful moments, and life can go by so fast. And that's one of the things I love about cooking, is because it brings people together, slows you down, and you share something delicious together. And somebody cooking for you is beautiful. And so then to bring that on to the next kind of level of memory of moments together, creating a beautiful table just visually captures that moment, and it makes everything just a little bit more special. And I think that, like, with just a small little effort, you can make your world more beautiful and more special to be in.
Well, I think that you give a lot of good entertaining tips as well with this book. So,
well, there are menus. Menus for a series of special occasions. You need to let me in on one secret.
Yeah.
I couldn't figure out why some of the pages, every now and then, some of the pages have a different colored paper.
Yeah, it's just kind of to make it all more visually stimulating.
Okay, I mean, there's not any particular reason for them. Isn't there color coding? You just decided certain pages should be green and certain pages should be brown.
Yeah, exactly. It's just kind of maybe some of them have links to the recipes and some of them are just because of the season or...
See, it's just such a silly man thing for me to want to think.
Yeah, it is really ridiculous.
Want to know that there's a logical explanation for it when clearly there's no need to have that.
Well, this is an extraordinary book as far as I'm concerned.
Thank
How
you.
Many St. Patrick's Day menus do you know of that includes wild nettle gnocchi with cashew blue sauce?
I know, that is amazing. Those gnocchi are so gorgeous. And yeah, I'm capturing them as being Irish. They're not Italian anymore. But I think what it is, for me, what the book is that it's for anybody who really wants to bring their Irishness into their kitchen and their everyday living and kind of hold on to their heritage. I'm hoping that people will really buy the book and just even try one different recipe every week and bring on the tradition to their daughters or their sons or their nieces or their nephews. Keep those cooking traditions alive in their family. And they're just really accessible, modern, fresh-tasting, easy recipes.
Well, you did it, Clodagh. Congratulations.
Yeah. No, I'll,
thank you so much.
Hold on a second. I'll bet you have a website. Why don't you speak your website into the interview, and I'll also put it on the page when we list the
program. Sure. Yeah, my website is Clodagh McKenna. That's Clodagh. McKenna.com.
And that's McKenna.
Yeah.
Not Scottish, an Irish Mac, right? A lot of people get confused because they think that anybody who has a last name beginning with Mac is Scottish, when in fact there are a large number who are Irish, including yourself.
Exactly. Mac is, the Scottish is usually with an A in it, M-A-C, and the Irish is usually M-C.
Okay. Got it. Well, I hope that you had a nice stay in New York. And
thank you so much.
And have a good trip home.
Yeah.
And,
are you marching on Saturday?
I'm actually going to be going back to Ireland on Friday, so I won't be marching on Saturday. But
so you'll be marching in Dublin on Saturday?
I'll be marching in Dublin on Tuesday.
Great.
Well, next time we're in Ireland, we'll stop and see you.
Please do.
Yeah.
So, thank you so much for having me on the show again.
Yeah, well, it was good talking to you, and I really find exceptional, this cookbook. So,
thanks so much.
Thanks, Clodagh. Ciao, ciao.
Bye. Bye, Peter. Ciao.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
We were very intrigued when, through our delivery system, we obtained a book entitled Modern German Cooking
since I think it was
new German
cooking. In a sense, it was our feeling that perhaps no such thing even existed. Of course,
you don't hear a whole lot about it, but there should be because everybody else has a new modern cuisine.
So why wouldn't there be a new German cuisine? And it turns out there is, and we got just the man to talk to us about it.
You know, I was kind of waiting for this to come out. Every other cuisine around has been updated and lightened up. Here we have Jeremy and Jessica Nolan. We're going to be talking to Jeremy. Jessica's not on the phone. Actually just did this. What everybody's doing with cuisine is modernizing it, updating it with German cooking. So this book is called New German Cooking. And Jeremy, you have an unusual background. You grew up with, your father was a chef.
Right.
And you were born on the West Coast, but then you went to Reading, which is Pennsylvania Dutch country, which is fairly conservative, and ended up in Philadelphia. Tell us a little bit more about your background.
Interesting. Like, I was born in California. We actually lived in four states for the first 4 years of my life, like California, Washington State, Rhode Island, and then eventually Pennsylvania. It was basically because of a job that my dad got that we ended up in the Reading area. And since I was so young, I was only 4 years old when we moved there, and my parents didn't really have any interest in leaving. I just got immersed in that, like, German heritage of that area. So, you know, both my parents have German heritage on their side, so they were interested in already, and just coming from areas that aren't predominantly German, like my mom is from Rhode Island, my dad's from Los Angeles, they never really had big exposure to that sort of thing. So when we moved to that area, it was like a culture shock to them. It was like kind of like reconnect with their ancestry and just learn all these different things. And it's kind of how I got started. Like, I was a little kid when we started going to all these places. And
but your dad, as a chef, did not cook German food.
No. My dad, you know, he started cooking in the 60s at a hotel and in California in Biltmore Plaza in Beverly Hills. And, you know, those back then were especially all the French restaurants were, like, in the hotels and stuff like that. So he was taught, like, classic French cooking, and that's kind of what he did. Like, he worked at a Sheraton hotel in Reading all throughout my childhood, and it was French restaurant, a casual restaurant, and banquets and stuff like that. But the German food interest was always there, and that's when we started going to, like, these private German clubs. There's several of them in the area. There's German butchers and restaurants, and you just kind of get immersed in that culture.
What does that mean? Because we have one of those clubs that has Manieres in something like that kind of word in the title of it.
The German club we have, one of them is a singing society called the Liederkranz, which, you know, it translates to like a singing circle, basically, or a crown. And that was founded in the 1800s as like a way of preserving German culture for the people that came from Germany in that area, that lived in that area. And it was all basically about like singing songs and preserving that tradition of like song and dance and stuff. And eventually they started doing festivals, like they do a big Oktoberfest, they do like a Mai Fest. And then eventually when they got club grounds, they made a restaurant. So basically it's a private club that you can go to Thursday, Friday, Saturday to eat in the restaurant. There's always events going on. And you know,
yeah, we have one of those here in Pittsburgh. They wear Lederhosen and the whole works.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and that's
Mankier, but it's Teutonic Mankier or something.
In a way, it's a little bit like a country club.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, for German heritage and culture, like people that want to preserve that, either where they're from or where their ancestors came from.
Yeah, I was in Reading in 1972.
Yeah,
first time I came to the United States, and I went to a restaurant called River Edge.
Still there.
Reading, which was really nice.
Still there?
Yeah.
It was an impressive restaurant for Reading, which didn't impress me all that much.
Yeah, it's still there. I've been there a really long time, but it's been there for a long time.
Well, now, tell us, like, what you're cooking, both of you, at two places in Philadelphia?
Yeah, Brauhaus Schmitz is the big, like, German beer hall restaurant. It's like it's a 220-seat restaurant, really large. And Wirtshaus Schmitz is our German delicatessen sandwich stand in the Reading Terminal Market.
Oh, great. Boy, yeah. I missed that.
Yeah, it's still going on. You remember how horrified you were when they said they were going to close it?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I shop there regularly. I had three shopping places. One was the 9th Street Market. Other one was the Reading Terminal Market. And then I had a neighborhood sort of upscale grocery store. with a butcher. So that was good. Philadelphia was good. Now, you start out, you really cut out a task for yourself. You started out with sausage, schnitzel, and sauerkraut being what comes to mind with almost everybody talking or thinking about German food. And you were absolutely right if you throw in soft pretzels with that.
Yeah, exactly.
But you set out to modernize and put a contemporary version of this cuisine, a German cooking, on the map.
Right.
Have you done that?
I think we just got started, really. I mean, the book just came out, but at the restaurant, we've been doing it for about 5 years. And regionally, we do really well. Like, we're a really busy restaurant. We've always been since we've opened. We've actually expanded the restaurant almost 3 years ago. We doubled the restaurant. I think we've done well in Philadelphia now. Like, it's kind of a way of taking it to the national level with this book and showing other Americans that there is a different side to German food and stuff that I've experienced in Germany, and I wanted to show Americans that there's a different thing in the German culture or the cuisine that most Americans don't know about, and that's kind of like where we went with that.
Yeah, you bring up a number of these things that are misconceptions of
right.
contemporary thing. One, that there is nothing but meat on the menu. Two, that everything's heavy.
Yep.
And yeah, and fatty. And what was the other one? The other one was that salads didn't exist.
Right, yeah.
So tell us a little bit about those three things. You did start out with a lot of traditional recipes here.
Yeah, we definitely wanted to add some of the traditional stuff that just kind of adds to, like, the backstory of the book, showing that, like, this is what's kind of traditional, but maybe our version of it. But it's also part of the new German cooking, in addition to, like, showing a modern, more lighter version of the food, is also showing Americans different German food that might not be new, but new to them. Like, something, like, good example is, like, Griebenschmalz, which is herb, like, rendered pork fat and the cracklings and stuff. It's very common in Germany, but a lot of Americans don't know about it. And I think that's also part of the new German cooking is showing.
That sounded good, but it didn't sound like it was diet food.
No, it's not. Definitely not. But it's something that's it's pretty common, especially in Bavaria. And I think it's something that a lot of Americans don't know about. So part of the book is showing Americans some traditional stuff that's just new to Americans.
See, I never even heard of Brotzeit, but that's a big thing, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Like it's one of those. It's like the English tea time kind of thing. In the Brotzeit, you know, you would sit down with your friends and have a beer and, like, bring out a bunch of snacks and stuff. Like, last time I was in Germany with our manager, Beate, in her town, her friend owns, like, a little Gasthaus, and in the afternoon it had Brotzeit. We sat down, they poured some beers, they came out with, like, the Griebenschmalz and bread and cheese spreads and, like, sliced meats and stuff. We just kind of, you know, hung out outside and had some beer and some snacks.
Well, you know,
now you're not afraid to experiment with ingredients. I love the idea of your schnitzel made out of sweetbreads.
Yeah, that's something cool, and that comes from my dad's, like, classical French training. Like, sweetbreads is one of those classical French dishes, and he made it many times, and I've had it made by him, and I've always enjoyed it, and that was just something trying to think of different ways of doing things. And then we were like, me and my sous chef were thought about it, and, like, you know, sweetbreads make such a good schnitzel. If we just poach it, slice it thin, bread it, and fry it, like, it would have a really nice texture and stuff, and it came out really nice.
Oh, I want some of that for my dinner tonight.
Yeah, I would too.
There you go.
Why do I want scummy old fish?
Yeah.
Is that what we're having for dinner, scummy old fish?
We're having fish. We're having nice fish, but still nice. Be fish.
Now, can I be guaranteed by you that these soft Bavarian pretzels are the best recipe you could ever dream up? You worked hard on it, huh?
Yeah, I think so. And it's a lot of pretzels, even in Germany, like, some of them can be kind of plain, like, real bland tasting, where I had a bunch of different pretzels in Germany, and I remembered a specific one that had, like, a nice little bit of sweetness to it and really nice flavor and everything. That was the thing that I tried to replicate. And that's, like, you know, my wife and I worked on that for a long time, where she was making it, and my friends would come over, and we would just kind of hang out and, I don't know, watch football on a Sunday, and she would make pretzels, and we would all try them, so.
So now, do you make your own sauerkraut? This fermentation thing is taking off. Everybody's making great vats of sauerkraut.
I would. I mean, we do it for specials and stuff like that, but in the restaurant, every week, we go through, like, 200 to 300 pounds of sauerkraut, and it would be impossible for us to ferment all that. Like, we would need a warehouse just of cabbage fermenting.
Right. But you do have this crispy sauerkraut fritter, which I thought sounded interesting.
Yeah, that's a really good dish. And that actually is another thing that, like, is something from my dad. It was something that he made New Year's Eve when we would have parties when I was a kid, and all of his friends would come over, and he would always make these things. And my sister and I loved them when we were kids. It was just, like, such a perfect little snack. And the restaurant opened, like, I was 6 months in or so. Like, I called my dad, and I just thought about that for some reason and called him and asked him how to make it. And he kind of just went over it with me, and then we just developed our own recipe based on that.
When you say that these recipes are not all equal in terms of ease of making the dishes,
right?
And I'm looking at one right now, which is, first of all, it's not that simple. Secondly, it's a hard sell, head cheese.
Right.
And it's hard getting the ingredients.
Yeah, that's one of those things that, like, the recipe itself is definitely not simple. It's not something that every home cook is going to tackle. The head cheese salad, on the other hand, if you buy the head cheese, it's really simple and it's really good. And it's one of those, like, it's kind of like a chicken salad or ham salad, but with head cheese. And it just is a really interesting flavor and stuff. The head cheese and some of the sausage recipes, those are something, I don't expect a lot of home cooks to, like, try to tackle that kind of recipe, but I think it's important that, like, other chefs and other, like, people who are into making sausage and stuff might be interested in trying to make something like that.
Yeah, I mean, sausage making.
So you've got a first audience of people cooking at home, but then you're also setting an example for chefs who are interested in branching out as well.
Yeah, I think definitely, like, this will appeal to some chefs as well. Like, I'm sure they'll understand that it's designed for home cook, but there's just, like, things in here, like the sausages and, like, the sweetbread schnitzel or the head cheese or something that would be more appealing to a chef than, say, like a home cook or something.
The Hessen Pfeffer sounds really wonderful.
Yeah, you like that.
I like the idea of that.
Yeah, that's a good one.
But you've got a great tip that you can get the effect that you want by using crumbled up blood sausage instead of having to use whole blood.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's one of the things that
makes it just a little more convenient, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely, and easier to acquire than blood.
Yeah, all the traditional rabbit stew dishes, or even the French, they all involve blood.
Right.
Well, here you have something else. You have seafood in here, which I never associate with German cooking.
Yeah, most people don't.
So tell us about the seafood.
I think with the seafood, like, you gotta remember, like, the northern part of Germany borders the ocean, so there's a lot more of that Scandinavian influence that we would assume, like, is only Scandinavian, but there's, like, pickled and smoked fish and, like, fresh fish and just cured fish and stuff like that. The fresh fish is definitely more prominent in the northern part of Germany than the southern part, and it was just something I definitely wanted to feature here, because it just shows another side of German food that people don't normally associate with the fish side of it. And I think, like, you'll see plenty of stuff, like Rollmops, for example, it's a pickled herring.
I love that stuff.
Yeah, and it's really common in Germany, all over Germany. They eat it everywhere. And a lot of Americans, if they have some kind of an experience with Germany or something, will know what it is, but a lot of them won't. And I think those things were something I just wanted to show, like a different side of that German food.
This is one recipe here. We're going to have to put to good use, Rabbit. It's a roasted goose with pretzel, apple stuffing, and Gewürz glaze.
Yeah, that's like the traditional holiday dinner for Germans is goose. Uh-huh. The pretzel stuffing is not traditional, but the goose is the traditional part of it.
Well, we did a goose once, and
Peter
did it on the grill.
Goose on the outdoor grill on Christmas Day.
Nice.
And it was cold.
Crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I mean.
And our son said it was the best meat he'd ever tasted, and when could he have it again?
Yeah, exactly.
It was goose is great. Like, it's, you know, it's such a nice, rich flavor to it. And
I only ever made it once. It was expensive, and then by the time we got done with easing off some of the fat, there was even less left.
Yeah, it's definitely not cheap, but we actually do it at the restaurant every year for the holidays. Like, you can order in advance, and it's for, like, 8 people.
Sure.
And we do, like, a whole roasted goose dinner with all the sides and all that stuff. And
sure.
Well, that's special stuff. We did find a source for geese.
In South Dakota.
In South Dakota.
Right, okay.
You know about them?
No.
Their specialty is actually not only raising the geese, but also cooking and smoking them and selling them already finished just to be warmed up.
Oh, okay.
Which is an interesting kind of idea.
Yeah, definitely, yeah.
And that's where you could get, if you're really into confit, you could get goose fat, tons of it.
You could. They sent us some goose fat as well as
15 pounds of it.
Yeah. So we gave it to a chef friend who was our friend forever.
Yeah, who really is into charcuterie and stuff.
Very nice.
So talk about what constitutes real authentic German potato salad. I never ever had it with mayo. You talk about Americans put mayo in it. We never had it with mayo.
Yeah, the German potato salad. So many people, I think, in the United States always assume that has bacon in it, which I've never found in Germany. It might exist somewhere. I'm not sure where. But also, this is the way I was taught by the volunteers at the German club, who are like older women that have been cooking German food for 50 or 60 years. And this is their version. Like, this is what they taught me, like the real traditional German potato salad is.
So what's in it?
Oil, vinegar, onions, parsley, and salt and pepper, and potatoes.
That's how we used to have it.
Yeah, well, yeah, that's a very Italian salad too, right?
And that in French, I mean, they like the vinaigrette.
And now, your wife is a pastry chef.
Right.
Now, that always has been, for me, one of the most... My best friend growing up's mother was German, and she used to bake regularly twice a week. And this was the highlight of our young lives, is getting Mrs. Dean's baked goods. And particularly, I still have a recipe somewhere for a streusel.
Yeah, I mean, German baked goods are definitely known. German and Austrian, for sure. Like, they're really good with sweet stuff.
And you have this bee sting cake in here. What you said, you've not updated it at all because it was just so perfect the way it's always been made.
Yeah, and that's another example of, like, the new-to-Americans German cooking. Like, bee sting cake is really popular in Germany and well-known, and I think most people in the United States, when they think of German desserts, they think of apple strudel, maybe Black Forest cake, and German chocolate cake, which isn't even German to begin with, but we've gotten that so many times in the restaurant where people say, how can we not have German chocolate cake? Because German chocolate cake's not German. Like, it's actually German brand with the brand of chocolate a long time ago. But that's an example of something that is a really good traditional dish that's new to Americans, because it's really good the way it is, and there's no reason to change it.
I wish you a lot of success in this book. I think it's going to change a lot of people's ideas about what constitutes German cuisine or what can constitute.
Well, I sure hope it does.
You think so? In the meantime, you got a successful enterprise going along there anyway, right?
Yeah, but we're actually about to open another restaurant, but not German, American place. But
oh, okay. Well, you'll have to, when that's up and running, you must come back on and tell us about that too.
Yeah, it'll be soon. So,
oh, really?
In Philadelphia, okay. Also?
Yeah. Yeah, it's going to be at 5th and Bainbridge, right around the corner from us.
Okay.
It's an American place, but we'll be open in, like, April.
Okay,
all right. Well, we'll be sure to let us know. I'm assuming you have a website, and there'll probably be news about it there, too. So why don't you read that into the program?
The restaurant's going to be called Whetstone Tavern. Whetstone is all one word, W-H-E-T, stone. Kind of like a real classic American tavern.
Okay.
The name Whetstone, as well as being a sharpening stone for knives and everything, is actually my mom's maiden name.
Oh, really?
So
it kind of makes sense that I got into this industry, and it's, you know, a tool to sharpen knives, and it's my mom's maiden name. So
that's great.
And what's the website for your restaurant today?
For Brauhaus or what's that?
Yeah, Brauhaus.
It's brauhausschmitz.com.
Okay, well, that'll be up on the banner on the program listing when we're on the air, and we wish you success with your new opening, and thank you so much for your contribution to
thanks for having me.
Enhancing the reputation of German food.
Yeah, well, I'm trying.
You could take on British food next.
Yeah. I actually did work at a British restaurant in Reading where I grew up.
There you go. Well, things are changing back in the old country, thank goodness, for the better.
Yeah, well, it's funny because the place I worked in Reading is called the Speckled Hen, and I opened it as a chef, and that was kind of where we took traditional British food and kind of updated it a little bit. And that was based on it a few times that I went to London or, you know, something like that. And I was like, wow, the food here is much better than everyone thinks it is.
Exactly.
And that was kind of our idea. So I just took that and then did it with German food 10 years later.
Wonderful. Well, it seems like you've done a really good job. And on behalf of our audience, we thank you very much for that.
All right. Thanks for having me.
Bye-bye.
All right. Bye.
Boy, the hour sure went fast this week, didn't it, sweetheart?
Yeah, it did.
Amazing that we're come to the end of today's program, but not to worry, because you can get more of the same time, same place next week. We hope you'll join us then. And in the meantime,
bye-bye.